Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. In Episode 3, we concentrate on the Commercial Lunar Payload Service missions, otherwise known as CLPS, CLPS. Before that, let's take another quick look at the Lunar HMAP mission.
Hi, this is Craig Hargrove. I'm an assistant professor at the ASU School of Earth and Space Exploration, and I'm the principal investigator for LunaMap, the Lunar Polar Hydrogen Mapper mission. We were the first SIMPLEX mission selection back in 2015. So we are manifested along with 12 other CubeSats on SLS Artemis 1. And our mission is to map South Pole hydrogen enrichments within and outside of the permanently shadowed regions at spatial scales of around or less than 20 square kilometers. And in order to do so, we needed to design a new type of neutron spectrometer for small spacecraft, and the spacecraft will have its own navigation and communications back to Earth using the Deep Space Network, so we will navigate into lunar orbit after deployment from the SLS. So it's a tall order for such a very small spacecraft. So this is actually some of the motivation for the mission. This is a neutron derived hydrogen, a map of the south pole of the Moon made with Lunar Prospector's neutron spectrometer at fairly coarse spatial resolution. And one of the unique things about neutron spectroscopy is it provides an integrated view of the top meter of lunar regolith. And LunaMap will be focusing primarily on epithermal neutrons, which down to about 40 centimeters or so. So we're getting a view of the more of the bulk as opposed to just the surface or optical surface of the lunar regolith. They're very very coarse spatial resolutions. These are sort of what we're planning to focus on, the regions of focus for LunaMap. One of the things we want to map is resolving the hydrogen within permanently shadowed craters as well as outside of permanently shadowed craters to understand if the contributions from previous neutron measurements with their coarse resolution was perhaps incorporating hydrogen within the permanently shadowed regions in some of those areas in the previous maps that showed enrichments in the areas outside of PSRs. Our trajectory design, we deploy from SLS in that little number one, and we go out to the weak stability boundary and come back. We use a little ion propulsion system, provides a very weak thrust, but it's very high ISP, so we have enough fuel in about the size of a tissue box propulsion system to get ourselves back into lunar capture. Depending on the Earth, Moon, Sun position of the SLS launch, that can take anywhere up to a year, but as short as 4 to 5 months, depending on the launch trajectory. The other thing I'd point out is we fly very low over the South Pole, so we'll make only over the South Pole. And we'll be operating the spacecraft from ASU. Thank you.
He was speaking in July of 2020. Bethany Alham is from Caltech, the California Institute of Technology. She's working on the Lunar Trailblazer.
So Lunar Trailblazer mission selected in June of 2019 under the Simplex competitive call that was open to the planetary science across the solar system with small satellites. We're jointly funded by PSD and SCO, and we are currently slated to go on NASA's mission IMAP. So thrilled to have that slot in 2024 to make our way to the moon as an Espagrande small sat. Lunar Trailblazer's goal is to understand the form, abundance, and distribution of water on the moon in the lunar water cycles. Our first two objectives really focus on the sunlit side of the moon. So the things we want to measure with Lunar Trailblazer are the form, abundance, and distribution of water, meaning the form, distinguishing OH versus OH in minerals versus H2O. Okay, so form, abundance, how much, and distribution. And then whether it's time varying in terms of the mobility. And those will measure as a function of latitude, soil maturity, and lithology. The other thing in most are the form and abundance of ice versus bound H2O and OH in the permanently shadowed regions, perhaps resolving some of the questions that Paul was pointing out in his talk, using terrain scattered light to see what is at the surface. So Lunar Trailblazer is a surface sensing satellite in terms of our direct detection of water. And then we'll, of course, get thermophysical properties, objective four, to understand how gradients and albedo and surface temperature influence the locations where we see ice and then bound H2O and OH. Along the way, I mean, we're going to get some awesome maps of geology for composition in terms of lithology. Those of you who are also fans of igneous petrology will be getting better spectral resolution than M-cubed and Diviner Force, the kind of next set of measurements and refinements of igneous composition, and being able to do recon for some of the landed missions we're talking about. We do this via two instruments. So an imaging spectrometer, HVM cubed, which has heritage from M cubed and then was miniaturized under a Picasso tech specs there, less than 70 meters per pixel, a spectral range that includes the full water-related vibrational absorption at a 10 nanometer spectral resolution. And then the lunar thermal mapper, these data sets are co-nested. So we get even higher resolution thermal pixels for composition and temperature within the HVM cubed pixels where we're sensing water from reflected infrared light at the surface. And the simultaneous thermal mapper enables us to correct. Our performance requirement is set not just by detecting ice, but actually detecting ice and discriminating it from mineral-bound water, which is really crucial for understanding the resources question and also scientifically understanding what's there. And so you can see that difference if you then convert that and bring that through a model for radiance using terrain scattered light off the shadows. Our baseline is that we're collecting targeted data of the moon in select locales. And I'll conclude by saying Trailblazer will supply spatially resolved maps of H2O ice, yep, OH H2O at less than 500 meters per pixel. We'll have a spectral range that enables us to also see organics, CO2, CH4, what's listed there, if it is there, and thermophysical properties of the surface at less than 50 meters. So I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Meanwhile, John Keller from the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, is working on HALOS, the Hydrogen Albedo Lunar Observations at the Surface mission.
The solar wind is an important contributor to space weathering alongside other processes such as micrometeorite impacts. In many ways, hydrogen in the solar wind drives the chemistry of space weathering. What is HALOS? HALOS is a two-instrument suite for measuring solar wind ions and backscattered ions and neutral particles from the surface. The goal of HALOS is to determine the dynamics of the lunar hydrogen volatile cycle, specifically obtain the backscatter proton and hydrogen outflow from the local lunar surface as a function of local time and temperature, quantify the signatures of the putative diurnal migration of hydrogen products and determine their origin, and also derive any space environment effects on anomalous escape of hydrogen. Early speculation was that hydrogen ions in the solar wind could directly form water when combined with oxygen in the lunar regolith. This hasn't been observed in the laboratory experiments at solar wind energies. However, the formation of OH hydroxyl bonds by solar wind energy ions has. Furthermore, the hydrogen implanted into the regolith sets conditions for subsequent water formation by energetic processes, such as micrometeorite impacts, and this has been observed in the lab by simulating with a laser micrometeorite impacts. Solar wind hydrogen maintains the chemically reducing conditions of the lunar surface that drives the formation of nanophase iron and enables subsequent formation of larger microphase iron. And it's worth pointing out that the formation of nanophase iron is not favored thermodynamically, but the reaction is driven forward by saturating the surface with implanted hydrogen. So the payload of HALOS consists of two instruments, ion and energetic neutral atom spectrometers. Each instrument would be mounted so that the sputtered and reflected particles from the surface could be observed. Because of their cylindrical symmetry, the analyzers will also measure simultaneously incoming particles from the zenith direction. Finally, HALOS is a landing site agnostic, capable of making important measurements anywhere on the moon, at least where the solar wind can get to. And we certainly have additional or increased interest in around polar regions and lunar swirls.
Mehdi Benner of NASA is working on LEMS, L-E-M-S, the Lunar Environmental Monitoring Station. He was speaking in July of 2020.
So I would like to give you a little bit of an overview about what about LEMS. LEMS, as you said, stands for the Lunar Environment Monitoring Station, a selected instrument suite by DALI. So LEMS, in a nutshell, LEMS is a compact, autonomous, and self-sustaining instrument package that was designed to enable long-term in-situ monitoring of the lunar environment for a nominal duration of 2 years from its deployment on the surface of the moon. LEMS does not require resources to operate, so it carries all the needed resources from power, thermal, digital control, and communication that's required for these instruments to operate. And the only requirement for it to function on the surface of the moon is that you get it there. So we do have a requirement for deployments on the surface, whether by a robotic lander or by a crewed mission. But once you put it on the surface, it deploys itself and operates for the nominal duration of at least 2 years. In its first version, the station is baselined to carry two instruments, a quadrupole mass spectrometer and a seismometer. The mass spec will be tasked with collecting daily measurements of exospheric composition. So the station operate the mass specs once every 20 Earth hours, and for about 20 minutes that allow us to sample the ambient exosphere, and then we do that again 24 hours after for about 30 times during a lunar lunation. The seismometer, however, operate continuously and basically will be always listening to the seismic activities of the moon, and the goal there is to constrain the structure and of the lunar interior. The LEMS package is designed to address the GATO survey goals, and more specifically, the state of the lunar exosphere by constraining its composition and expanding the inventory of known volatiles at the surface, and then look at its dynamics in response to processes like tidal driven outgassing, micrometeoroid or transport and surface interaction. The having a seismometer opens up widely open a new line of investigation related to the structure of the lunar interior. It serves to constrain the lunar exosphere, but also should you have multiple of these stations on the surface, you can do constrain the structure of the lunar interior.
One of the first rovers to go to the moon in the Artemis era will be Viper. Antti Kolopret is going to discuss this and justify why it is. By the way, you should know that a PSR is a permanently shadowed region.
Most of you have probably heard about Viper, and all of you understand that the last decade has been revolutionary in terms of our appreciation for the types and ranges of water on the moon. Viper's one of several next steps. If you saw Amy's talk, it fits in nicely into the broad set of steps needed to really get the information we need for sustainability. It's a lunar surface rover mission. It's really intending to conduct exploration science, which is modeled after terrestrial resource exploration. So it'll be really the first extraterrestrial resource exploration mission in many ways. The rover is about a 450-kilogram class rover. The four science instruments are a neutron spectrometer out front. We have a near-infrared spectrometer system and a M-SOLO mass spectrometer system on the underside of the rover. And they are looking at the surface under the rover continuously, but also importantly, when we drill with the Trident drill, that's a 1 meter drill that brings samples up in 10 centimeter bites that we will examine. It is really a reconnaissance mission in such that it is all about getting lots of coverage and lots of areas of different thermal stability regimes for with regards to water. It's trying to understand the range of possibilities, not necessarily hunt for water, but actually get the data that will help us constrain resource maps that we develop here on Earth. So it's meant to travel considerable distances. We've done a lot of analysis as to how much coverage is needed to get a certain certainty or uncertainty or confidence in our understanding of an area. It's definitely meant to go into multiple different regions, including PSRs, and doing all these measurements, looking at the surface and subsurface. It also needs to characterize the environment in which we're studying. So looking at temperatures, surface and subsurface temperatures, isotopes, the geology, mineralogy, etc. So it's going to return a wealth of knowledge in a broad set of thermal regimes. Okay. And I've pointed out an area that we call a safe haven. It's an area that has considerably short periods of shadow. This is a place that we return to periodically to survive. The rover is a solar rover. It doesn't have any nuclear component to it. So to survive shadows, it needs good thermal systems and batteries. And that's what we do. We go to and from the safe haven, exploring the dark areas right here, because we have all these dark regions that are within a few kilometers of this safe haven. Red is the PSRs, and I just include a little extra information here on PSRs. One of the requirements is that we have at least 224 meters of unique driving in a PSR, starting 30 meters within a PSR, and that's to account for uncertainty in the DEMs, and conduct at least one drill down to 100 centimeters. So we will actually be driving fairly deep into a PSR and getting quite a good coverage in these PSRs.
Daniel Moriarty hails from the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and he has a plan for something called AEGIS, A-E-G-I-S, the Aerogel Experiment Gathering Impactor Samples. It's going to be part of the CLIPS program.
So today we'll be talking about an early stage instrument concept designed to enrich and diversify the samples returned by the Artemis program. So the core instrument team is here at Goddard. So as Carly envisioned, the Artemis program encompasses sustained human and robotic activity around the lunar South Pole with a regular cadence of landings and launches, as well as support from orbital assets. Assets at the Artemis site and in orbit are subject to a variety of small impactors. So two important types of these impactors are micrometeorites and also regolith particles that can be accelerated by rocket exhaust during spacecraft landings and launches. So although both of these impactor classes pose a potential hazard to human and robotic activity, they are also of high scientific interest. The basic principles of these processes are understood through numerical modeling and laboratory experiments. However, these analyses are only loosely constrained by lunar surface observations. So this really limits our ability to understand and mitigate the hazards posed. Furthermore, the Artemis architecture is unprecedented in terms of its duration, complexity, and also the polar environment. So the actual impactor environment that is experienced may be significantly different from kind of what we're predicting. So the Aerogel Experiment Gathering Impactor Samples, or AEGIS, is an instrument concept that would greatly improve our understanding of the flux and other properties of micrometeorites and exhaust plume particles. So the AEGIS concept employs aerogel panels at the lunar surface and potentially in orbit, which are going to be optimized to capture both micrometeorites and exhaust plume particles. So surface-deployed Aegis panes would be collected by Artemis astronauts for return to Earth, which allows detailed analysis of things like the particle flux, particle composition, size, trajectory, and other properties. Installation of replacement aerogel panels for collection during subsequent missions would enable assessment of the evolution of the region through time. Aegis addresses several high-priority science and exploration goals, which will feed back into the implementation of the aerogel collectors. So Aegis will address the flux and composition of micrometeorites impacting the lunar surface to better understand the reservoir of these impactors. So this can help constrain models of near-Earth object origin and depletion. The instrument may also capture early solar system materials and interstellar particles, and this is relevant to critical cosmochemistry questions. Micrometeorite compositions may also shed light on the current rate of volatile delivery to the lunar surface. Aegis will also help determine the energies and trajectories of micrometeorites to better understand their role in space weathering and also hazards posed to human and robotic lunar surface activity. In addition to micrometeorites, Aegis will also record the flux, trajectories, energies, compositions, and other physical properties of blast zone particles to better understand the energy coupling between land or exhaust and the lunar surface, and then the hazards that those pose to lunar surface activity. Recent models by Phil Metzger suggest that significant volumes of regolith particles may also be accelerated beyond the lunar escape velocity by landers, and this potentially poses a risk to orbital assets. There's been some pushback on this model, but an orbital Aegis deployment, perhaps on the Gateway, could help constrain the magnitude of this process. And through repeated surface deployments, Aegis can also help understand the evolution of the blast zone particle load through repeated landings of variable spacecraft sizes, engine configurations, and locations.
Also from the Goddard Space Flight Center is Mike Barker. He proposes a Moonbar micro rover. He was speaking about this in August of 2020. And you should know that PSR is a permanently shadowed region, an area that doesn't ever get the sun on it. Vesta is an asteroid, and Kelvin is a measure of temperature, and LRO is a lunar reconnaissance orbiter that has been orbiting the moon since 2009.
Okay, so thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak today and introduce a concept for a micro rover or a targeted investigation of lunar regolith. The surface of the moon is covered in regolith, loose, unconsolidated soil with typical grain size of several tens of microns, and it's the source of much of what we know about the moon. Yet we've never really directly observed it at the grain scale in its natural state. Remote sensing studies of the moon and other airless bodies throughout the solar system often invoke microstructural changes to the regolith related to its porosity, surface roughness, and these elaborate grain structures called fairy castles to explain remote sensing data over a range of wavelengths. But these hypotheses have never been directly tested on the moon or any body. Unfortunately, returned samples and photos from the moon are largely inadequate for definitively testing such hypotheses. The Apollo and Luna regolith samples have revolutionized our view of the moon, but their compaction states in the top few microns were likely fundamentally altered by the collection, transport, and storage in Earth's gravity. The highest resolution Apollo photographs were taken with the Apollo Lunar Surface Close-Up Camera. These images are really best for studying surface roughness on scales larger than about a tenth of a millimeter in the vicinity of the landers where the natural grain surface microstructure was likely disturbed. In 1963, Hopke and Van Horn hypothesized that the moon's top surface layer is extremely porous with many interconnected cavities. They conducted lab measurements of the optical scattering properties of many different surfaces with the goal of understanding the moon's peculiar photometric behavior, namely its low albedo, the sharp ubiquitous brightness enhancement near full moon, and the relatively little limb darkening observed across the face of the moon at full moon. And so they noted that if a dielectric, such as a piece of rock, is pulverized and sifted to small particles, which are then deposited individually in the lab with low velocity, The grains can build up these complicated structures of towers and branches that they called fairy castles. They saw that grains in these fairy castles can be supported by only one or two adjacent grains through adhesive forces. And they thought that the fairy castle microstructure could be built up over geologic time by electrostatic transport or micrometeorite bombardment. And Hopkin and Van Horn found that dark surfaces with such porous microstructures, much larger than the wavelength of light, can backscatter light towards the sun as strongly as the moon. And so they concluded that the top surface layer of the moon must have a very high porosity, perhaps as high as 90% or so, with many interconnected cavities. And so since that time, it's often hypothesized in the literature that changes to this top layer structure, if it exists, may be contributing to many of the variations in reflectance behavior seen in remote sensing data for the moon and other bodies. So from lander blast zones to new craters, swirls, and permanently shadowed regions, also to fresh crater ejecta on Vesta, the changes in reflectance properties at these sites suggest changes to the fairy castle structure, although there are competing explanations, such as changes to the surface roughness on slightly larger scales, like millimeters to centimeters, or the redistribution of materials. So there's, you know, there may be competing processes operating on different size scales, and it's not really clear yet which, if any, is dominant. And since we're targeting the South Pole for human exploration, I just want to highlight here the uncertainty that still exists in the role of enhanced fairy castling and porosity in contributing to the darkening of PSRs in the far UV, as observed by the LRO LAMP instrument. It seems likely that some amount of ice is required to explain the far UV spectrum and other measurements, but the exact amount depends to some extent on the porosity assumed for these regions. And it's been hypothesized that reduced thermal cycling or dielectric breakdown could potentially enhance the porosity in the PSRs. So this has important implications for how much ice is inferred from various measurements. So direct in situ measurements of the regolith porosity in PSRs would help address this issue. So these are just a few examples of how the surface microstructure may be contributing to reflectance behavior variations on the moon and other bodies. And what we need is direct in situ validation of this hypothesized structure or untouched regolith for any airless body at relevant resolution, as well as sampling the diversity of the surface over transect comparable to orbital pixel scales. So our concept for a solution is Moomba, a micro rover for a targeted investigation of lunar regolith, maybe more appropriately dust. The goal is to understand the top layer's structure and its effects on remote sensing measurements through the systematic and coordinated 3D microscopy and photometry of regolith in its natural state with a small rover microscope and lighting system. And so this is critical to the correct interpretation of surface observations from remote sensing and in situ studies of the moon and other airless bodies. So Moomba and a PSR, for example, would address multiple decadal survey questions related to the distribution sources and sinks of lunar volatiles. And regardless of site location, these types of measurements can provide much needed initial condition constraints to models of dust transport processes. So Moomba would be implemented as a small wheeled rover carrying no batteries, minimal power distribution, no data processing system, and no wireless communication, operated on a lightweight tether from a fixed base station that supports communication with Earth. And offloading power control and communication to the base station enables a low mass rover. The base station could be deployed by an astronaut or it could be on the lander itself. The tether would provide two-way fiber optic data transmission and power delivery that carries current to warm it and keep it flexible in shadow. And the tether can deploy from motorized reels on the base station and on the rover to minimize drag. And it could enable the rover to venture into PSRs at tens of Kelvin and increase power to heaters to maintain operating temperature. So primary instrumentation would be a down-looking monochrome 3D microscope with roughly 10 micron 3D resolution, meaning capable of resolving structures about 10 microns in size. Also a ring lighting system to control illumination angle, including direct co-aligned lighting with commandable color distribution. And additional instrumentation would include moderate resolution 1 to 2 megapixel cameras, forward-looking and reverse, and on the base station, all for context and remote driving control. The Moomba would move very slowly and methodically, minimizing grain scattering or ground vibrations that could disturb fragile grain structures. And the primary driving goal would be to drive nearly straight away from the base station to characterize the soil structure at multiple distances, and this is key, reaching beyond the blast zone for a systematic sampling of regolith structure and diversity. And the high data volume that would likely result would probably require that only a selected fraction of data be telemetered to Earth. But with astronaut deployment, the full data set could be stored on a device retrieved by astronauts and returned to Earth. So just to wrap up, if I had to summarize the sort of motivation into two top questions, it'd be, what is the 3D microstructure of undisturbed regolith, and does this structure change in permanently shadowed regions? And so our concept for addressing these and similar questions is for a small rover